be permitted to rot away, bury something, but you know they cannot be used, right? Is it because of the fact that you know you cannot recite the Arami Ovid Ovi concerning this? The Isal Kodateir, and if you think that Kriya Eina Akevis Bahem, that the recital of Sukkim is not an obstacle, is not a, you know, doesn't render them invalid, so am I Yikovel? Then why should you say that the fruits, you know, should be left to rot? I mean, why shouldn't it? Okay, he brought it after the Sukkim. But, you know, let's say, okay, so we can say the Pesukim over it. But to rot, why shouldn't the Kohen be permitted to eat it, right? So it says, Kidarabi Zeva. So the answer given is that this is in accordance with a statement made by Rabbi Zeva. The Omar Rabbi Zeva, Rabbi Zeva said, Kol harawi levila ein bilam akevis boy. This is a principle that we find again in Menachos, as I mentioned before. Menachos consists primarily of what? Of flour and oil, right? Okay. But what Rabbi Zeira is saying over here says that if it is the right amount for the mixture, so even if he didn't mix them together, it is not going to render the mincha invalid. But if it is not the right thing for the mixing of the oil and the flour, then in that particular case we would say that you know, this is not going to then in that case we say bilam akevis, that the mixing of them is, that is the failure to mix them, is going to render it invalid. Okay, what would be a failure? I mean, what is this bila that we're talking about? Of course, bila is a noun over here that the Gemara has, and naturally it's based upon what? Well, we said, soilus mincho belulo vashem, right? So, in other words, for the various menachos, there had to be a fixed amount. We learned the Gemara Menachos. We discovered that in the Beis HaMikdash they actually had measuring cups. These measuring cups were used in order to make sure that they have exactly, let's say, the right amount of flour prescribed. Because sometimes it had to be an isaron, or it has to be an A4, whatever, you know, the Torah says. Another time, maybe it's two A4s, or maybe it's a chatzi, or something like that. So they had measuring cups for the flour, and also for the oil, as well as for the wine that they needed in order to pour the wine libation. Okay? So, and you know, the amounts, the quantities, this depended on what the Torah itself says. As we know, par, you know, and so on, the saron, so it has this amount, and then the aisle has a different one, and the kevis has a different one, and so on. You see, so they all have different amounts. Now, let's say with the mincha that he was either too generous as far as the flour is concerned, or not generous enough. It had to be the exact amount. So what he's saying is, if you have the exact amount, even though they have not been mixed together, but nevertheless, it is a valid mincha. But if it's not the right amount, it's not ra'ui lebila, right? Then in that case, we say it's ma'akevis. In that particular case, it invalidates the thing because it has to be exact.
What's
okay?
It got to do with
yeah.
this?
Okay, you say, what does it have to do with it? The answer is that the same thing, going back to the Bikurim, okay? When it was proper to bring Bikurim and he brought it, understand? Then in that particular case, it would have been valid. What should he have done? if he was Hifrish. In other words, he designated it before Sukkos, then when should he have brought it and would be a valid Bikurim?
Sukkos.
Yeah. Why Sukkos? He had to bring it, okay? But if he first brings it after Sukkos, the time is gone and it's no good anymore. It would be different after Sukkos if it first ripened after Sukkos and he designates it. So in that particular case, even though he's not allowed to recite the Pesukim anymore, but we would say that the Kriya Eino Ma'akevis, the fact that, you know, he didn't recite it, this would not be an invalidation. But if it was improper to begin with, then certainly the whole thing is invalid in that particular case. So that's the parallel that he makes over here. Okay? All right, I think we're going to stop at this particular point.
Yeah. Actually, if the fruit ripened before Sukkos and he waited till after Sukkos, it would have been rotted anyway.
Well, look, it may have been only a matter of a week or two or something like that. I mean, I don't know what to tell you. Let's say on the 13th of Tishrei, he decided he was going to, that this was Bikurim, right? But he didn't get there on the 15th, or he didn't even get there, let's say, on the 16th or the 17th. I mean, after all, obviously, it doesn't say that it doesn't say only the first day of Sukkot passed. He had the entire week to bring it, okay?
Right.
The entire week of Sukkot. But if he didn't bring it during all that time, then in that case, his Bikurim are invalid. Well, had he been there at Hoshana Rabbah, that's the 7th day of Sukkot, he would have been there. With Simchas Torah, well, first of all, they didn't have Simchas Torah in those days. They had Shmini Atzeres, okay? But the question of Shmini Atzeres in itself, the Gemara and Sukkot, it's a little puzzled by the whole status of what Shmini Atzeres is. I don't mean puzzled about the fact that there is a Shmini Atzeres. Obviously, you have Shmini Atzeres. The Torah says so. It's Mikra Kodesh Yelachem. But the question is, does Shmini Atzeres count as a regel b'fnei atzmo? In other words, as a festival in its own right? Or is it simply the last day of the Sukkot festival? You understand? So you have conflicting views in the Gemara concerning what actually is the role. The official rule is that it's a regular b'fnei atzmo, that it's a holiday by itself. Nevertheless, if a person failed to come, let's say, to the Beis HaMikdash before Shmini Atzeres, he still, on Shmini Atzeres, could fulfill his obligation of, being there, of what we would call Olas Re'iyah. In other words, he comes to appear for to fulfill the obligation to appear on the Sholosh Regalim, and it would be counted as if he was there for Sukkot. So as I say, it's Lachan and Lachan.
When he would be able to make declaration.
So had he brought it, he could have made a declaration.
He could have.
Exactly, he could have, because the festival is not over from that point of view. I mean, he could have relied upon the Kula in this case, that inasmuch as we have makeup korbanos permitted on Shmini Atzeres, in that case we should have also a makeup bikurim. But you don't wait for the last minute. This is the important thing.
Actually, you don't eat in Sukkah on that day.
You're 100% right,
so
as far as Eretz Yisrael is concerned. For the Golah, that's a big question. And therefore, everybody has their own minhag. There's no question that if you do eat in the Sukkah on Shmini Atzeres, then in that case, you do not make the Brocha Leishei B'Sukkah. Everybody agrees.
Yeah.
Okay? But the question is, are you obligated to eat in the Sukkah on Shmini Atzeres in the Golah, because it counts as the second, on Simchas Torah? No, on Shmini Atzeres. Does it count? I mean, what we would say, a Yom Tov Sheni Shogolius or something like that. I don't mean in the sense that it's a yontav, but the fact is, how do you count? Is it like a completion of the 7 days, since we are in doubt as to when it should be or not? So there are differences of opinion about that, and people have different customs. Some, for example, will make Kiddush both nights in the Sukkah and eat the meal. Some will not make Kiddush in the Sukkah, and refuse to go in there at all, period. And others will say, look, okay, I'll skip a meal in the sukkah, especially if you have a rain falling then. There's no question. But, you know, in the morning, after shul, so, you know, I mean, after the davening, so you make a kiddush in the sukkah and you say goodbye sukkah, right? May we next year eat in Mevyotzen sukkah. So there are different customs concerning. Okay, we will stop at this particular point right now. Yudches, we're roughly more than halfway down over here.
Yudches, Amud Beis.
Yeah, we'll say after the right. Okay. Amud Beis.
And
as I said, a little bit more than halfway down, beginning with the words Rab Achava Yaakov.
And it's June 26, 1996.
That's right. Before I forget, I have to tell you, I'm going to be at Mount Holyoke next week, which means that because I have to supervise the supper as well as all the other meals during the day, I can't make it on time. Okay? So we'll have to skip next week, but we'll be back in business again 2 weeks from tonight to meet Hashem. Okay? And I told Solovey the same thing when I spoke to him. Just
will he be there next time?
Yeah, he said he'll be well enough by then. Hopes to come.
Good.
He was debating whether to come tonight, but he did not want to push his luck tonight because he had some heart trouble. The thing that started off this problem was about the Bikurim. Right? Remember, first fruits. What we learned last week was that there's a right time for Bikurim and then like a secondary time for Bikurim. In other words, if Bikurim are brought between Shavuos and Shmini Atzeres, or Sukkos to be exact, and you know, between so in that particular case, we learned that they are required to make the declaration, the Kriya. Okay? If, on the other hand, they bring it after Sukkot, then at that time they still have to bring Bikurim if the fruits first ripen at that particular time, but they did not make the Kriya. Of course, I mean by Kriya, I mean the fact that they have to recite the verses Aram Yobed Ovi, Vayir Mitzvayim, etc., etc. Okay? This is what we learned last time, but that was really like a second issue to the thing that started off the whole question. Namely, that the Mishnah itself says what? That if they ate, that is the Kohanim, if they would eat the first fruits that were brought to them as a gift, and they would eat it before the recitation of these verses, then they deserved malchus, right? On the other hand, we saw that there was another opinion that said that Korea is not ma'akevus. In other words, this does not invalidate it. If they recited or they didn't recite it, didn't invalidate it. But what would invalidate it? What would invalidate it would be if they failed to place the basket down. Hanoch, as it says. Okay? That would invalidate it. So this was one opinion that we saw.
Who failed to place the basket?
Okay. Who puts it down?
Yeah.
That's a very good question. We take a look at the psukim. Okay, let's get our commotion so we can understand better what the argument is about. Okay,
Is it the Kohanim or is it the one who brings the Bikurim?
That is an excellent question. Okay,
what is the verses that they say the same?
All right, let's take a look once more at what it says concerning the ceremony of the Bikurim. It's Parsha Kisavo. Kisavo. Okay, page 859 and 860.
Kisavo.
Kitavo. Okay. I say Kisavo.
That we understand.
859 and 860, okay?
Yeah, that they have the declaration there.
Correct. All right. So, you know, it's written, you know, below Kartam and Rishus Kopri Hadom and so on, that you have to bring from the land and so on, right?
Yeah.
And then it says put into a basket, you go to the place which God has chosen, in other words, the base of Mikdash, Vosla, Elakoyen, right? The Sheyevayim Ahim, And you have to say to him, first of all, Igarti Ayom L'Shem Lekech, I declare this day unto the Lord of God that I have now come to the land which the Lord swore to give us unto our ancestors, right? Shenishmas Shem La'Seinu L'Seslonu. And then it's written, V'lokach HaKeinah Tet M'Yodecho, right? The Kohen has to take the basket from your hand. And then it says, V'hi Nicho, which means, and he places it, right? And he sets it down. The thing is about the altar,
right.
So over here, what does it say? It says it's the Kohen, in other words. It's the implication.
Right.
But we're not finished yet. We're not finished
Some
yet.
Like it,
all right. Because then, what does it say? Then you have the business, you know, the text of the declaration.
Right.
This is what you have to proclaim before God. What? Arami Yovidovi, Svaimans, etc., and so on. Right? And then, you know, Vayesinu, Vayeno, and Mokimanzer, you know, we have to take this out from the slavery of Egypt. He brought us to this place, right? Vayitin, Lonisorot, Hazois, and he gave us this land. Eretz Zoras, Kotokosh, Lon, Flog, and Milk, and Honey. Viator, and now, Hinei, Heves, His Precious. Behold, I have now brought, right, the first fruits of the earth, which you have given me, O Lord. The Hinach To, which means, and you shall put it. You shall put it before the Lord your God, and you shall bow down before the Lord your God. All right. So, who is the one who is referred to right now?
The donor.
The donor, exactly. So there's like a contradiction, right? The Kohen puts it down. That's what the first one says, and here it says that the donor is the one who puts it down, right? So we'll see how the Gemara tries to solve the problem. Okay.
No,
that could be, but we'll see what the solution is. Okay. Let's not jump to conclusions at the moment. All right. At any rate, as we see, the machlokes at this particular point is whether it is hanocha, which is ma'akev, in other words, the fact that you have to put the basket down, is that if it were omitted, that would invalidate the ceremony? Or is it kriya, the recitation, which would invalidate it? As we saw from the Mishnah, stresses the fact, what? Kriya, right?
Kriya.
But as we saw, there was a difference of opinion, and one opinion stated that
it wasn't
kriya, which is ma'akevis, but it is hanocha. If you left that out, that's no good. I mean, it's what we had last time. And they based it upon the fact that twice we have the idea of putting it down. As we have seen now, it's the Kohen who puts it down, or the donor puts it down, right? But twice it is mentioned, and therefore, if it's mentioned twice, it must mean that this is even more necessary to the fulfillment of the mitzvah
than
the kriya. And particularly, of course, as additional proof that we're looking for it, is the fact that what have we learned? We also learned that if you bring after Sukkot, then you don't make the kriya. Yet, is it invalid?
No.
It still is valid. However, as we'll see, it's not quite the same. Okay.
But you still have to go through the same procedure of bringing it to the Kohen.
Right, right.
And placing it before the altar.
Yes, it should be done. Right. Okay. So, Rabbi Acha bar Yaakov, Masei Lor, Kedar Rabbi Yasi. Rabbi Acha bar Yaakov teaches this particular idea in accordance with the statement of Rabbi Yossi, who said, Omar Rabbi Yochanan, he says, V'kashalei to Rabbi Yochanan and Rabbi Yochanan. He says, you know, I find difficulties between one statement attributed to Rabbi Yochanan and another one. So they say, Yemi Omar Rabbi Yochanan. So tell me, did Rabbi Yochanan really say that Bikurim Hanocha Mi'akevis Bahen and Kriya Mi'akevis Bahen? That in the case of Bikurim, that if you failed to put down the basket, then this would invalidate it, right? Whereas if you failed to read the declaration, then this would not be invalidation. Did Rabbi Yochanan really say that? Or is it the other statement that Rabbi Yochanan made that says that both Kriya and Hanocha would invalidate it, right? If both of these were left out. In other words, you have to have both actions in order to do it.
Yeah.
Okay. So which is the right statement attributed? So he says, "Vabor mine Rabbi Yosef, Rabbi Yochanan." So this question was asked by Rabbi Yosef and Rabbi Yochanan, and he said, "Bikurim, as far as first fruits being mosai mutar lekohanim, tell me," he says, "when are the kohanim permitted to eat the fruit?" The Yom Alei. So Rabbi Yochanan answered him. He says, "Hora uyin likriyom, those that are fit to make the declaration, as we have said before, in other words, you know, if it is brought in the time between Shavuos and Sukkos, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then in that particular case, it's Mishekor Alehen, right? Then when does it become permitted to the Kohen? When the declaration has been made by the person bringing the Bikurim. V'sha'en ve'uyin l'kriya, but those that are not, I wouldn't say worthy, but those are not, required for a kriya for them. In other words, those that are brought after Sukkos, because we said they could be brought sometime between Sukkos and Chanukah, if it was a late ripening thing. So it's b'sharoi p'nei abayis. Then the Kohanim are able to eat it when you bring it into the sanctuary. Literally, when you can see the face of the temple. In other words, once it's brought within the temple courts, then in that particular case. Why? Because there's no kriya. So in that case, then that's when the Kohen could begin to eat it. But what is the implication of this? This is what I'm saying. The implication is this, that if he says that if they are brought at the proper time, you know, when the declaration has to be made, then obviously it cannot be eaten before what? Before the declaration has been made. So in this case we see that Rabbi Yochanan then is in agreement with the effect that kriya ma'akevus. In other words, if there is no kriya ma'akev, always means that it hinders it, it prevents it. In other words, it invalidates it. So, in other words, if he failed to make the declaration, then in that case, that invalidates the whole thing. So this actually is in contradiction with another sentence, another statement where they say that he decided that it is not kriya, but it is hanocha, which is ma'akevus. You understand? So there's a contradiction over there. So this is what they say. Kashya kriya kriya, we have a contradiction between whether kriya is obligatory or not, right? And kashya hanocha hanocha, and likewise the question about even placing the basket down, is that required or is it not required? So he says kriya kriya le kashya. Gemara says no, that's not really a contradiction. Why? Because Rabbi Shimon Harabana. They represent two different points of view. One point of view is the point of view of Rabbi Shimon, and the other one is the Rabbanan. It was the Rabbanan, if you remember, who said that Hanocha is Ma'akevus, but Kriya is not Ma'akevus, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, in that particular case, we have to assume that if Rabbi Yochanan is quoted as having said the opposite, then in that case, maybe it's either his own personal view, or maybe he was simply telling what the rabbis said, but he had a different point of view that conflicted. This is a possibility, okay? And also, Hanocha, Hanocha, Nami Lakasha. He says there's also no contradiction between what they have to say as to whether Hanocha is, will it invalidate or not, because of the fact that, again, it represents two different points of view. Who are the two different points of view this time? It's Hor Rabbi Yehuda and Hor Rabbanan. It represents a difference of opinion between Rabbi Yehuda and the Rabbanan. So they say, my Rabbi Yehuda, which statement of Rabbi Yehuda are you talking about? There are thousands of statements of Rabbi Yehuda. So the question is, which Rabbi Yehuda statement are we talking about? So he says, this is the statement. The Tanya, we learned, it says, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, he says, Behinachto. He says, you know what the word Behinachto means? You know, you are to place it down? He says, Zutanufo. This doesn't mean actually putting down the basket. What it means is waving the basket. Now what's waving the basket? So the answer is that
offering it.
Yeah, not only that, but you actually put your hands underneath the basket and you raise it up and down or maybe even like a lulav, right and left and backwards, forwards and so on, okay? But certainly up and down, there's no question. You have to have some kind of motion in order to create a wave. So this is why they call it tanufa, which means, of course, actually to raise something, okay? Or to wave something, mm-hmm. All right? So he says, this is what Hanocha means, according to Rabbi Yehuda. You think that the word Hanocha v'hinachto, this statement, right, that you shall put it down, which, remember, we said before, this is the donor himself mm-hmm. that it's the reference to. It says, you think that it means simply, you know, to wave it around, Hanocha. I mean, or does it mean lifting it up, or does it really mean Hanocha, putting it down? So he says, Kishahu Oimer, when the Pasuk says, V'hinicho, right? In other words, who shall put it down? So we saw this refer to the Kohen, right? Hare Hanocha Abor. So, okay, so there we see that it means Taka, putting it down. So tell me, why does then the Torah come along and add another statement and say the hinachto, and you shall put it down, literally, right? So he says, zu tenufo. This refers to the fact that the waving has to take place. Okay. Now, of course, who does the waving? That was the question that we asked before. So the answer is that the man who holds the basket that he's presenting to the kohen, right? He holds it, naturally puts his hands underneath the basket, and then the kohen puts his hands underneath the hands of the person holding the basket. And then they raise it together, right? And they raise it, lower it, as I say, it may be right and left and so, in order to create a waving motion, to show gratitude to God and that they're all sharing it. Okay? Uman Tana de Faligale de Rabbi Yehuda. And who is the Tana who is in a disagreement with Rabbi Yehuda? So he says it's Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. The answer is that it's Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. The Tanya, as we have learned, it says, Veloka hakoin hatenem yodecho, right? It says that the coin has to take the basket from your hand, literally. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So he says, Limeid al Bikurim, this teaches us concerning Bikurim, Shetu Unin Tenufo, that it requires, waving, right? Divrei Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. These are the words of Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov. And says, My Talmud, Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, what is the reason for Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov's statement to this effect? So he says, Asya Yad Yad Mishlomi. Says he derives it by a gezeira shava. Remember what we said, a gezeira shava means that there is a similarity of language. If there's a similarity of language and you have a tradition that this is applicable, because you can't simply take two words like SS or something like that, except the mother would say it to a child maybe. and you cannot say that, you know, therefore what applies to this pasuk applies to the other. No, it has to be something, an unusual word that they share in common, and secondly that the tradition has already been established by a known authority that he has it on the basis of having heard from his teacher, who heard it from his teacher, and so on. That the Gezeirah Shavah works.
Real Gezeirah
Shavah. Right. That's the Gezeirah Shavah. Okay. So he says, he derives it from a Gezeirah Shavah, derived from a law concerning Shlomim. Shlomim, we remember, these are literally the peace offerings. What do we mean by peace offerings? Well, there are several categories of peace offerings. The two most common ones happen to be shlomim, and the other one is todah. Okay? Now, shlomim specifically is for any kind of a festive occasion that a person wants to celebrate with the family, whatever, you know, the Rabbeinu Shalom has blessed them, and he feels a sense of he wants to acknowledge it and at the same time have a religious experience together with everyone. So he brings an animal to the Beis HaMikdosh, they shecht it, and you have three partners, as we already learned in it, right? The Mizbeach, representing the Rabbeinu Shalom, gets the blood and certain fats, okay? the Kohen gets his, it's a Roah, Lechayayim, Keva, in other words, he gets certain parts of the body that are given to the Kohen specifically as his gift, okay? And last but not least, the rest of the animal can be eaten by the person who gives the sacrifice, together with his family and anybody else he wants to invite in order to share in the meal, okay? So, and also there's a difference in the time given to eating. I mean, namely that it has to be eaten shtei yomim v'layla echad. In other words, it can be eaten that day, that night, and then the following day. But after that, it's going to become nosur, as we learned, and it has to be destroyed. Okay. That's the rule concerning shlamim. Todah is already a different story, but it's also shlamim, because it is, you know, we translate it as Thanksgiving offering, right? But it's based upon Kapitel Kuf Zayin in Tilim, which speaks about different events that happen to a human being where a person is in danger from one way or another, and he's rescued from that danger, and so he brings a Thanksgiving offering. As for example, a person has gone through serious illness, okay? He wants to express his thanks to Rabbeinu Shalom that he's had over for Shlema. So he comes to the Beis HaMikdosh and he offers a Todah.
Like we say.
Right, exactly. What we have Bench and Goymel. It's based upon the same idea. Exactly. And the same thing, we've taken a dangerous trip someplace. So again, you know, this is what the Kapitel in Tilim, you know, stresses different events. And he's gone through a wilderness and things like that. So at any rate, or let's say you're in prison and you're released from prison, thank God it doesn't happen to any of us, but in that case, again, if a person was in prison in those days, I don't have to tell you that the authorities very often would imprison people. The Romans were certainly not very sparing of prison as far as, you know, Jews were concerned. So if you were released from prison after being in there, so in that particular case, you brought a Todah in order to write. And there are also different kinds of rules that the Torah has in connection with the Torah, that they have to bring four different types of wafers as mincha, as the meal offering. And according to the Gemara, actually it's the four times that you bring 10 of each one. So in other words, you have to have 40 different wafers. Some of them in the deep fry, and some of them simply mixed together, some of them in the flat fry, and so on and so forth. Okay? And among them, for example, is chometz, which is the only time that a mincha ever contains chometz. Okay? And that's the reason why, when it comes to Erev Pesach, and Chol HaMoed Pesach, what don't we say in our daily davening? Bismillah Soda, you don't say it because of the fact that the Todah contained chametz, and so therefore we omit it on those occasions. Okay, we also omit it incidentally Erev Yom Kippur, because on that day they were so busy preparing the Beis HaMikdosh that they didn't have time for fancy offerings. They did only what was prescribed on that particular day in order to get everything ready. So after all, you know that this was the most important event taking place in the Beis HaMikdash, when the Kohen Gadol had to prepare in order to carry out the entire ritual of Yom Kippur. And there was a tremendous strain on him, because he wasn't eating, just as none of us were eating on that day. And he had to make sure that everything was done properly, and he had a shecht, he had a sprinkle, he had to bring katoris and everything else, and so on, so that... And he kept on changing his garments. They had linen garments, had changed into gold garments into linen garments, and each time he had to go and take a dip in the mikveh and so on and so forth. So that's why they also didn't say it Erev Yom Kippur. They didn't have a Korban Todah on that day. But otherwise, you know, this is what it represents. All right. So at any rate, by the way, the Todah can only be eaten Yom V'Laila. That's it.
That night.
Right. That day and that night, not beyond it. And if it goes beyond again, it becomes dosar. Okay.
Does that mean until Shacharis?
Right. Of course, Chachamim, this we learned in the very beginning of Brachos, that even though they were kosher kol alayla, but nevertheless, the Chachamim said ad chatzos, because they wanted to make sure that people would not
go beyond.
Right. Kedela harchik es ha'adom in ha'avir, as the Mishnah says over there, right? In order to remove people from the possibility of transgression. Yeah. All right. So getting back. All right. in connection with Shlomim, the word Yod is found. Kesiv Hocha, right? In the case of Bikurim, Hocha means of this case, right? Which is Bikurim that we're still talking about. Case of Bikurim, what is written over there says, Veloka HaKoyin HaTena BiYodecha, right? That the coin is to take
your hand.
The basket from your hand. Uksiv, and in the case of Shlomim, what is written over there says, Yodov Tavieno Eis Hashem HaShem, that his hands, in other words, the donor's hands, right, are to bring the fire offering of the Lord. So, Ma Khan, just as over here, Kohen, the Kohen has to accept it from whom? From the donor, right? So, Afla Halon, so likewise over there, Kohen, he also has to accept the Shlomim and so on, right? From the person who was given them, okay? Amala halan ba'olim, and just as in the case of Shlomim, the owner also has a share, as we said, right? And he has to actually have an action. What is his action? His action is that he brings the korban with his own hands, right? So afkan ba'olim. So likewise over here, the owner, the fruit, who brings it, you know, he also has to have a share in doing something with the basket of fruit that he brings, right? Paul Ketzad, so how is this accomplished, that both the Kohen and the donor, right, better word in this case, the donor, you know, they both have to do something physically with it. So he says, Baniya Kohen Yodav Tachas Yadav Be'olim, right? So this is where we learn that the Kohen has to place his hands underneath the hands of the person, of the donor, umeinu, and he waves it. Okay? All right. Let's take a look a little bit at the Rashi. All right. The Rashi begins, I'll start from over here, with Horu'uyan Likriya. Okay? See if you can see. It's roughly about two-thirds of the way down.
Yeah.
The first word on the line says Yochanan. Okay?
Yeah.
All right. So, Ruin Likriya says, Mi'atzeres Yadachag, in other words, from Shavuos. Remember that in the Lashon of the Gemara, Shavuos is always referred to as Atzeres. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Let's not mix it up with Shmini Atzeres. Okay. All right. So, in other words, from Shavuos until, and what is Hachag? Of course, that is Sukkot. That's the time, you know, when it is proper to make the declaration, right? So, but if it is not, in other words, if it's the later period, then Mishiyiru Pnei Abayis, which means Mishiyiru Konsulazor, the time when the first fruits literally enter the courtyard, right? And in that particular case, Vanocha Lomar Kevitz Klal. And the fact that the putting down the basket, if he omitted that, then this would not be an ikuf. It would not invalidate the service. So it says, "Ho Rabbi Yehuda, the Rabbi Yehuda loy ma'akla." Hanochi says, as far as Rabbi Yehuda is concerned, the fact that you failed to do the Hanochi, this is would not invalidate it. The Dorish, because he interprets the word ma'akla, right, as Yisera l'tnufa, since it's mentioned again, you know, the hinachto, which after comes after the hinicho. So why do we have to have it twice? So he says he interprets the second one as referring to tenufa, right? The yain mikro shanui behanocha la'akev, and so therefore, according to Rabbi Yehuda, there is no pasuk that says that if you left out the hanocha, that would invalidate it. So this is his opinion. But Ula Rabbonon, as far as the rabbis, Le Dorshulei, Lehochi, right? They did not use this interpretation of Rabbi Yehuda. So, Miboyelahu, they need it. Lishnos Ba'anocha, why does the Torah then mention Anocha twice? So is the answer is that as far as the rabbis are concerned, it's La'ake, that if you left out Anocha, then in that case you have not fulfilled the mitzvah of bringing Bikur. And then, of course, he says, "Ve'inachto zutnufa," right? That the second pasuk, "and thou shalt, lay it down." This refers actually to tenufa. Kori be'inachto, loshon, ve'loinocham elokim. it's interesting how Rashi says over here that the hinach, though he does interpret from the word lahadiach, which means to place down, to put down, but he says rather it is derived from the word b'lei nocham elikim. This, if you remember, is at the beginning of Parsha Bishalach, where it says that God did not lead them derech eretz plishtim, through the land of the Philistines, right? Tikharofu. I mean, that journey would be too short, and the Rebbeinu Shalom was afraid that that way, if the people would have any difficulty, they would run back again
to Egypt.
To Egypt, right, exactly. So he takes the word, the hinachto, in the sense to guide them. God did not lead them, God did not guide them. So that therefore, he takes it in the sense that what does the Kohen do? The Kohen has to guide the donor, right, okay? And he explains, Shehu mancha oso, right? In other words, he guides him le arba ruchos, to the four directions. In other words, to the east, to the south, the west, the north. It's a question, you know, when we shake the lulav, there are different customs about that. Nusach Ashkenaz is the way that I strive, you know, that this way, straight ahead, actually since we're facing east, that's it, right?
East.
And then we go to the south, right? And then we go to the west, and then we go to the north, and then we go up, and we go down. Yeah. This is our custom. Chassidim have a different custom. They go forward, backward, it's a very complicated business, but okay? Everyone through his own custom.
Long you waver.
Right. So anyway, so this is what he says, and he describes, right? In the four directions, as I said, you know, east and south and north, west and north. Umale, and also he has to raise it up. Umorid, and then he has to put it down. Okay. Now, man tanu de poli galei lemimah anocha miakva, who is the tanu who disagrees with him and says that anocha will, that if you fail to do it, then it's going to invalidate it. It's Rabbi Yehuda ben Yaakovi, right? The nafkalei tenufa mikrachina. And he derives the idea of tenufa from a different pasuk, namely, mala halan be'olim. In other words, he is the one who made the comparison to Shlomim, right? Mm-hmm. And he said, mala halan be'olim, just as there, in the case of the Shlomim, da'u be'olim ishtoi, because obviously it is referring to the person who's bringing it, right? Dichsiv, because it's written over there, Yovi es korbano l'Hashem, he has to bring his korban to Hashem, and the Mizevach Shlomov, right, from the sacrifice of his peace offerings. And then one of the next words, which Rashi didn't quote, this is what we have over here, Yodov Tuviyeno es, is. Es korban Hashem, es yishei Hashem, right? That you know, his hands have to bring the offering unto God. Okay, so the word yodov is there. Okay, the samech le, yeah, yodov to Vienna, as Rashi says. I'm anticipating Rashi. Okay. They tell a Jewish joke, you know, that person who anticipated, you know, on his own, and then he sees him going over to Rashi. The Rashi agrees with him. He says, Baruch Hashem. Shekivanti, the Rashi. In other words, thank God, he says, that I had the same idea that Rashi had. Okay. So, Gemara continues on the bottom of the next page, at the bottom of the page over here, right? Omer Rava Baroda. Rava Baroda said over Rabbi Yitzchak, Bikurim. The first fruits, may a motzai bechayven aleihen. At what point, in other words, would you become literally obligated concerning them? But it's not what it seems. This is not what we were talking about before. We were talking before about, you know, whether, right, you bring it and so on and so forth. But now the question is, let's say that someone who had no right to eat them, naturally, who alone was permitted to eat bikurim?
Only
the kohen. And only after, you know, the proper ceremony had taken place, right? whether you say it is putting it down, whether you say it's reading, whether you say
waving,
you wave it, which incidentally becomes the final thing. Obviously, that you know, you have to do something, as
right.
I said before. So that becomes the accepted idea. But what happened if somebody who had no business eating Bikurim ate them? So as Rashi explains, being Mosai Chayov, that heaven says, Misa Zorho Ofen. In other words, the person who eats them deserves the death penalty. Of course, as we said before, it doesn't mean actually that he's going to be executed for it, but it does mean Misa B'day Shemayim. In other words, we'll banish him and we'll punish him because he did an Aveira which, you know, he had no business doing. It was specifically commanded, you know, the what the right thing was, okay? So, Mishayiru Pnei Habayis. It's when the Bikurim actually come into the temple court. At that particular point, if anybody were to eat the fruit,
at that point,
and the right, and he had no right to eat it, then in that particular case, he would deserve Misa B'day Shemayim.
This could happen before he even turned it over to the coin.
Yes, but let's say what would happen if, let's say, he came to Yerushalayim, but he didn't actually go into the city and he felt hungry. And so what did he do?
He ate it.
He ate some of the fruit. I don't know whether he ate the entire fruit, as we'll see that they discussed the question in just a moment. Okay. But he ate some fruit.
The donor himself.
Which then the donor himself ate the fruit that he was supposed to do what?
Give
was
to
supposed
the
to bring and you know, bring it to the kohen, right? So in that particular case, if he was not yet in Yerushalayim, he was not yet in the Beis HaMikdash, because he says Mishiru Pnei Habayis, it means that they actually have to be you know, have to enter the temple courtyard where you see, you know, the devir, in other words, the major structure of the temple. Okay? So if you wait before, then in that particular case, technically you would not deserve the death penalty. You were negligent. You were doing business. No set quantity for Bikurim. There is no set quantity, certainly not as far as the Chachamim would say. You know, we say in the morning, right?
The point.
Eilu Devarim Shemahem Shir, right? Hapeya. In other words, how much of a corner of the field to leave? How much? The Habikurim, first fruits. How much first fruits you have to bring to the Beis HaMikdash? Maybe if you bring two or three fruits, it's the Dayenu, you know.
I think the whole idea is that you shouldn't eat it before you give it to the talent.
Yeah. Right, right. Okay.
The whole idea, you shouldn't eat the first fruit. God should be given the first fruit.
Sure.
Through the coin.
Right, okay.
And
very
then
nice.
You can eat the rest of your crop with the first fruit.
Right.
Once he committed what he was bringing, then bring it.
Bring it, right.
Correct. Okay, so it says, come on, in accordance with whose opinion is this, that it's only Mishayuru Pnei Habayis? So he says, Kehai Tana, it's in accordance with a Tana, the Tanya, who taught as follows, that Rabbi Eliezer Omer, Bikurim, right, Miksosim Bachutz, Miksosim Bifnim, some of the fruit is outside the city wall, actually. This is what it means. Bakutz only means the city wall of Yerushalayim, okay? So in other words, he was bringing his basket. He didn't quite get to Yerushalayim yet, okay? So he decided to eat some of the fruit, and then the rest of the fruit he brought into Yerushalayim, he brought to the Beis HaMikdash, right? So it's Miksoson Bakutz, right? Or Miksoson Bifnim, right? Some inside, some outside, and some inside. Okay. Shebachutz, those that are outside Yerushalayim, harei hein kichulin l'chol divrehem. Then they are like any other non-sacred object in any capacity, in any way. In other words, he could eat it. Didn't act like a gentleman, he didn't do what was right, shouldn't have done it, should really have reserved it all, you know, as after all, you know, he set it aside all this time in order to bring to the Beis HaMikdash. So he should have brought it in its entirety, but he didn't do it. But the fruit that he ate still had not yet attained the status of sanctity. But once he brings it within Yerushalayim, now it attains the status of sanctity, and in that case, this has to be given to the kohen. And if he ate it prior to giving it to the Kohen, then in this particular case he would be
Chayav Misa.
Chayav Misa, right. Okay?
You didn't have to worry at that time whether it was East Jerusalem or West Jerusalem.
No. Those days, Yerushalayim, Ki Yir Shechuvo Lo Yachdav, as King David said.
There is.
A city that was joined together, right? That was united together. United Jerusalem. So, okay, so he says, Shebachutz Harehen Kecholin L'chol Divrehem, right? And that fruit, which is outside the city wall that was eaten, they are still like Cholin. You know, not sanctified in every respect. But Shebifnim, once it's inside, then Hare Henke Hektish the Chodiv. Then it becomes like any other sanctified food or object in every way. Okay. So Omar Rab Sheshes said, Bikurim Hanocha Me'akeves Bahed, Kriyan Me'akeves Bahed. Back again to the same argument, right? That according to Rab Sheshes, Bikurim, if you left out the Hanocha, if you left out, you know, placing the basket down, or as interpreted later, you know, by Rabbi Eliezer ben Yaakov, in the sense that it means actually to move for it, they have to raise it, and so on and so forth, right? So, if you omitted that, then in that particular case, you have not fulfilled the mitzvah of bringing Bikurim, right? Then it invalidates it. Whereas, Kriya, he says, Ein Ma'akeves Bahen, right? If you've omitted the declaration of Arami, Yovid, Ovi, etc., so that would not invalidate it. Come on. So his statement, Rav Sheshes' statement, is in agreement with whom? He says, Kahai Tana de Tanya. It's in accordance, you know, with the statement where we learned, Rabbi Yossi says, Shloisha Devorim, Mishum Shloisha Zakenim. He says, I have three teachings from three great rabbis. Doesn't mean three each, but it means
each one
says something great, that I have a tradition and I want to tell you about it. Okay? Rabbi Yishmael, he was the first one that he's quoting. So what was this teaching of Rabbi Yishmael? So Rabbi Yishmael, Omer, Yochol Ya'ale Odomai Sosheni Basman Hazeh B'Yushalayim Yochlenu. He says, tell me, is it possible that a person can bring Maisa Sheni to Yerushalayim? Remember, Maisa Sheni is the food that he has to bring to the Beis HaMikdash. It has to be Dagon, Tirosh, right? In other words, things made out of grain or corn or wine or oil and so on. He has to bring these things to the Beis HaMikdash and eat it in Yerushalayim, as we said, right? So, shall we say that Bazman Hazeh, that even now, when there is no Beis HaMikdash in Yerushalayim, shall we say that a person should still bring his Maaser Sheni, his second tithe, to Yerushalayim and eat it in Yerushalayim? V'dinhu, and we could argue logically that this takeh should be the din, right? On what basis? So actually, we see that they're going to come to a contrary conclusion, because the comparison that they're making is with the Bechor, alright? Bechor, as you know, the first born animal, if it is a male, right? Of course, when I say first born, I mean to its mother, right?
Right.
It's a Petarechem, okay?
Petarechem, yeah. First,
so,
first,
right,
first
the first
issue.
One out of the mother's womb, okay? Alright. So, the Bechor has to be brought to Yerushalayim, okay? And there, of course, the Bechor is eaten. Naturally, who eats at the Bechor? The answer is that the Kohen has to get it, okay? Because it is holy and part of it has to be offered up on the altar, etc., etc. Okay. So, he says, Bechor to'un havas mokom, right? Let's compare, he says. In the case of the Bechor, it involves that it has to be brought to the place, namely brought to where? To the Beis HaMikdash. That's what they mean by hamokom, okay? Maaser Sheni also is Tohun Havos Mokom. That too has to be brought to the place, of course in this case not necessarily the Beis HaMikdash, but has to be brought to Yerushalayim. So in other words, both of these involve that they have to be brought to a certain place in order to be eaten. Either the Beis HaMikdash or to Yerushalayim proper. Okay? So, Ma Bechor Eino Elo Bifnei Abayis, just as the Bechor can only be offered up while there is a Beis HaMikdash in existence, but you can't do it otherwise because, as we already said, you know, part of the animal has to be sprinkled on the altar and so on before the kohen can eat the rest of it. So it involves that there has to be a mizbeach for it. You understand?
Right.
If there is no mizbeach anymore, then the business of the bechor is out. Of course, I do have to tell you that the bechor is a more complicated business than all this, because even Basman Hazeb, even now that we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, if you have, I mean, if you're a farmer and you have a herd of cattle and you have a firstborn animal to, you know, let's say born to a cow or to a sheep,
whatever,
or to a goat, I mean, those are the three animals which are involved, okay? Then in that particular case, that animal is holy. Holy in what sense? Because the Torah says, Lo sa'avod b'chor sherecho, you're not allowed to put it to work. In other words, you can't take that animal and make it do labor.
Right.
Yeah, the lo sogoz b'chor tzanecha, and if it's a sheep, you're not allowed to shear it. Not allowed to do it. So that law was never repealed, since it's a Torah law. So that would still apply. The only thing is that we also have problems of what we call a mum kavua. In other words, a permanent mum, as compared to a mum over, only a temporary mum. And if it is judged to be a mum kavua, in other words, it would be invalidated even today, so that the kohen could not get it as a sacrifice because it wasn't. Then in that particular case, the law is that what you're allowed to do with this animal is to shecht it and eat it. That's the only thing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, we are so agricultural right now that we're not even aware that there is such a thing. But it's a fact, I mean, that the law still applies in that respect. But not in the respect that you have to bring it to the Beis HaMikdash and give it to the kohen. Mm-hmm. That, of course, doesn't apply anymore. Okay. So,
well, obviously, if there's no Beis HaMikdash, you can't give it to the kohen.
Right, of course. So ma bechor eino el b'fnei habayis, right? So just as the firstborn animal can only, the law concerning it can only be, you know, while the temple is in base, is in existence. So af ma'aser eino el b'fnei habayis. So likewise, ma'aser sheni also cannot apply except if the temple is in existence. Okay. Well, as we'll see, they're going to argue back and forth about this particular point. Mal v'chor shekein toan matan domim v'yachurim legavei mizbeach. Right? So, how about a different point? Point is that the bechor involves what? Sprinkling blood, right? And offering up certain parts of the animal, as we said before, you know, the fat, the chalev, in other words, and the Yeseres HaKovej, the Akloyos, and so on and so forth. In other words, like lobes on the liver and the two kidneys, that was also offered up on the Mizbeach. Okay? That was burnt on the Mizbeach. So, Bikurim Yochichu, you're going to prove that Bikurim too? Look, Ma le Bikurim Shekein Tu Nanocho, right? It has its own law. In other words, Bechor has its law. What? Matan Domim and Emurim, right? And as far as the Bikurim, they have a law of what? Of Hanocha, right? So in other words, what are we trying to say? Since they each have their own distinctive feature, so how can we draw a common denominator between one and the other? This is the question, really, that they're aiming at, okay? So he says, Talmud Loimar, Torah says as follows, says V'chalto shom lefnei ad Hashem lekech, right? You are to eat the, actually the word shom does not belong over here, although it's, you have various pesukim over there. One pasuk does say V'chalto shom lefnei ad Hashem lekech, another one says simply V'chalto lefnei ad Hashem lekech. Okay, so since we're talking now about the Meiser, Maaser Sheni, which we find also in Parsha Re'eh, Aser Te'aser over there, right? The Ochalt of the Hashem Lekev is what the Pasuk says. So this is in reference to Maaser. So he says, Makish Maaser Levechor. it's from the business of the eating that we make a comparison between Ma'aser Sheni, between second tithe, and the law of the Bechor. Ma Bechor Eino Elefnei Habayis. So just as the Bechor cannot be eaten except when the Beis Hamikdash is in existence, of course I'm not talking about the Bechor that has a Mum Kavua, I'm talking about a Bechor without a blemish in it. So Af Ma'aser, right? So likewise Ma'aser Eino Elefnei Habayis. Okay? So likewise, Ma'aser, in other words, second tithe, can only be applied when there is a Beis HaMikdash in existence. Alright, I think we'll stop at this particular point. My throat is beginning to get a little weary. I felt bad a little bit that, you know, last Wednesday night I had a skip. Course, you know, they say that if you're involved in the mitzvah, so you're putter from the mitzvah. I don't like to be putter from the mitzvah learning, but it was such an important event in our own life that we were able to celebrate with our daughter and son-in-law and my son-in-law's family, you know, the chasana and the shalom brachas and so on. Next week, I'm involved in a different mitzvah, and that is that I have to see to it that Mount Holyoke, at least Prospect Hall over there, is going to be kosher. Which means that I have to take charge of the meals that they're serving over there, the kitchen, the meals, and so on. So I can't make it back over here at 7 o'clock. That's an impossibility. I can't even make it back at 7:30. If you wanted to come to learn, them.
Well, me 2 weeks from tonight.
Yeah, definitely will be.
That will be somewhere in July then.
Yeah, about the exact date. Tenth
is a Wednesday.
Tenth of July.
Is a Wednesday. Thank you. Okay. That's right, because the 4th of July is on Thursday. The 4th. Am I going to have a bad 4th of July this year? Okay, we are now on your test on the dollar, middle of the page, right?
All right.
Okay, and this is where we will continue. B'yotz Hashem, 2 weeks from tonight.
All right. July 10th.
Yes.
And we're on Amad Yud Tes.
Right. We continue. Yes, your test on the dollar. We continue from where we left off at our previous session. All right. So now he says, we imiso. Okay, you agree. Now, Lifrach, you know what? I can give a counter argument. Lifrach always means, literally, usually it's like, mitzabrecht. In other words, you come back with an argument in order to counter what has been said. Here we've gone ahead and we built a beautiful hekesh, so to speak, in other words, a comparison. Hekesh is a comparison. No. Between the Bechor and between Ma'aser, and we said that since we know that the Bechor cannot be eaten except while the Beis HaMikdash is in existence, so likewise you cannot eat Ma'aser Sheni in Yerushalayim unless the Beis HaMikdash is in existence, right? So now he says, look, I got a counter argument. What's the counter argument? He says, Ma lebikurim shekentunin kriyo v'hanocha. Look, he says, how can you compare Bikurim, says, how can you compare, you know, these two? In other words, to draw a comparison between Ma'aser and between Bechorim. Guess what? He says, I can bring in a counter argument from Bikurim. What about Bikurim? Bikurim, he says, Shekein Tun and Kriya V'Hanocha. The argument that we made last time about the eating of the Bechor was based on the fact that why can't a Bechor be eaten? Bisman Hazeh, right? Today, that there is no Beis HaMikdash. Why can it not be eaten by the Kohen, of course, we're talking about, okay? In Yerushalayim. So the answer that we gave is because there are certain parts of the Bechor that the Kohen has to first offer up on the Mizbeach. There's dam, you know, there's blood, there's chalev, there's a certain prohibited fat that has to be burned, okay? And also, in general, if you have kochim kalim, in other words, you know, those things that are eaten by a family celebration or something like that, so then we also have what we call the amurim. In other words, they have to take out other parts and burn them, okay? Shtei hakloyos, yiseres halakoved. Yiseres halakoved means the like a little lobe on the liver, and the kidneys have to be burnt, and so on and so forth. All right, so obviously, to do all that requires an altar There cannot be an altar without the base of the Ekdosh, and so therefore we have to say, obviously, there cannot be a Bechor, alright?
Mm-hmm.
But the counter argument is this. You said that Maaser requires being, you know, eaten in Yerushalayim, that we know because the Pasuk says so, okay? And if it has to be eaten in Yerushalayim, and then in that particular case, then just as the Bechor has to be eaten in Beis HaMikdash, so therefore Maaser should also be eaten within the area of Yerushalayim, right? So now he says, look, I don't like your comparison because I can bring a counter argument. Good evening, Roland. And the counter argument is from Bikurim. What is the counter argument from Bikurim? So we said, Bikurim does not require what? Doesn't require sacrificing anything on the altar, right? And yet, we know that Bikurim cannot be eaten except where? In the Beis HaMikdash. Why? Because he says there are two indispensable elements involved in the Bikurim. Namely, one of them, as we said, is Kriya. In other words, he has to make a declaration that, you know, that he thanks God for having brought us to this land and relates all the trials and tribulations that our ancestors had to face, Aram Yovid Ovi, etc., etc. And then, you know, then he has to say, behold, now I have brought this. So this is a declaration that he must make. And the other thing is the Hanocha, which, as we showed, twice the word Hanocha is mentioned in the very same passage. In one case it says Vehinachto, and in the other case it says Vehinicho. And how did we reconcile it, if you remember? So we said the answer is because both parties are involved, both the person who brings the basket of Bikurim and also the Kohen who accepts the Bikurim, the basket of Bikurim, and this required, as we said, Tenufo. In other words, he has to put his hands underneath the hands of the donor, right? And then they raise it, we said, and you know, they do it to you know, all directions, right? The east, the south, the north, the west, and also up and down, just as we have the same rule concerning the lulav, the shaking of it. This has to be done. But where can it only be done? In the Beis HaMikdash. It requires the Beis HaMikdash. So here we can say then in that case, then let's argue from Bikurim. Namely what? That Maaser Sheni should also require that just as we cannot bring Bikurim, in other words, but Zman Hazeh, because it requires a Beis HaMikdash, right? So why can't we argue then that if that's the case, then Maaser Sheni too cannot be eaten in Yerushalayim Bazman Hazeh? Of course, we're talking about the fact that in those days Maaser Sheni, you know, was brought, people would bring, you know, a tenth of whatever the earth had produced, wine, grain, oil, and they would bring it to the Beis HaMikdash and they would eat it over there. But what do we learn about what happens with the fruits? That's right. Well, if he knows that he cannot bring them to Yerushalayim and they will preserve, so you know, right? In that case, he has to be poida. This is what we call pidyon or pidyon. In other words, he has to redeem them before he gets to Yerushalayim, right? And the money he has to spend in order to buy food within Yerushalayim.
Right.
But, of course, this argument is going to come up now. Namely, what happens if a person brings fruits which are 100% without any blemish, they're good, they're ripe and everything else, and he brings it within Yerushalayim, right? Then can he redeem it in Yerushalayim? Can he sell it and buy something else with it?
I don't know.
No, cannot, because the minute that it comes into Yerushalayim, as we said, you know,
holy.
It gets within the gates, right? Then in that particular case, this is Makdish. It makes it holy. And from that point on, he has to go ahead and bring it to the Beis HaMikdash and present it to the Kohen. Before he got to Yerushalayim, he could have done it. But once in Yerushalayim, he cannot do it because these are holy. So far, so good. Okay? Of course, then, the next question that we will ask, what happens if the fruit gets spoiled within Yerushalayim? Can he redeem it in Yerushalayim?
Can you sell spoiled fruit?
That's the difference between a teacher and a businessman.
Good question. Right, but the answer is he could sell it, you know, for go to the market and sell it for the cheapest amount of money that he can get. But he has to use that money, of course, in order to buy good stuff. Okay. But if the fruit is 100% excellent, good, then in that case, it has become sanctified. Mm-hmm. All right. But, of course, again, the question is, Bezman Hazer, what is the whole deal, right? So, yeah. All right. So, okay. So, okay. Yeah. Where am I over here? Right. It says, oh, okay. Yeah. All right, Yusulifa. That's where we get started from. You know, a lot of the words look alike. Okay. So Amar Rabashi comes up with another idea. He says, Nidi Kuvaleko, he says, okay, since we're on the subject of Maaser Sheni, right? Remember, the whole question was whether today you can bring Maaser Sheni to Yerushalayim and eat it there, even though the Beis HaMikdash is not. And he says, that's what they're arguing, okay? So he says, okay. He says, all right, granted, Nehi, the Kuvaleko, all right. We, you might argue that, you know, that these, it is not a, this, it is not an indispensable thing, right? What is not indispensable? We would assume that he's talking, of course, about what? Both the Kriya and the Hanocha, right? Both the declaration and also the fact that it has to put the basket down by the altar, right? But he says, okay, maybe they're maybe they're not indispensable, right? The Ikuva. In other words, if, let's say, the Kohen and the donor of the Bikurim didn't put it down on the ground and they didn't make the declaration, would it still be valid Bikurim? Maybe it's not really required, just that it's the right thing. And this is what they mean over here. It says, mitzvah mileka. Tell me, isn't there, however, a mitzvah? Now, mitzvah over here means, in other words, isn't it, as we've seen it a couple of times before, that the word mitzvah implies something that is the right thing to do, even if, technically, you can say that something would be valid without the performance of it. In other words, what he's arguing is as follows. He says, okay, maybe we have proved before that, let's say, Kriya is not necessary. That if he hadn't read, the, you know, made the declaration, then it would still be valid. As a matter of fact, we saw one.
Yes. Huh? So in the Torah, you got
to. Of course, the Torah says that. Absolutely. Twice. Right. Of course, it said, right.
So how can he wave it off?
Because he still wants to pursue an argument. Okay. Two amendments. He's arguing, okay? But his argument runs as follows. Okay, maybe I'll grant you, he says, that maybe they are not indispensable. But nevertheless, he says, mitzvah mileka, isn't it a mitzvah nevertheless to fulfill it? In other words, to carry it on and do the things that you're supposed to do? There could be a difference, in other words, between technicalities that would invalidate it and the right thing to do. And the right thing, of course, is what? Kriya and Hanocha. So he says, well, Ifrich, you know what? We can give another argument. Elo Omar Rabashi, but Rabashi said, what? Kevan de Ika Bikure Hagir, de Boy Le Meymar, Shandishpa, de Shemla Vesenu, Vele Botsi. Omar Lopsika. All right. Alright, so he comes up with another argument over here. Okay? Says, you know, there are times when, let's say, the Kriya as a matter of fact, is not only not indispensable, right? But as a matter of fact, there are times, even occasioned by the law itself, as we find in the Mishnah Bikurim, that the kriya would not take place. When would the kriya not take place? This I discussed, I remember, 2 weeks ago when I mentioned it. I mentioned that, remember, we learned that there are definite periods of the year when Bikurim have to be brought. Okay? They cannot be brought any earlier than what? What is the festival of Bikurim? Shavuos,
right?
Right? Or as the Talmud would call Atzeres.
Right.
Okay. So that's the earliest period. Now, we learned that if he brings it any time between Atzeres and Achag, which of course means Sukkos, then in that case he would be subject both to Kriya and Hanocha. That's the right way to carry out the mitzvah. Okay? What if, however, he brought it sometime after Sukkos, between Sukkos and Hanukkah? Then what did we say? We said that in that case, Hanocha is still applicable,
but not
Kriya. He does not make the declaration at that time. So now along comes another Mishnah, also in the Mishnah Bikurim, which says, I can give you another case where technically Kriya is not required, not only not required, but it shouldn't be recited at all. What is that case? So he says, that case is the case of Bikurei Hager. In other words, a person becomes converted to Yiddishkeit. Okay? Now, a person who becomes converted to Yiddishkeit is a Jew for all practical purposes and has to be treated exactly like a 100% Jew. It's wrong to throw up in the presence of a ger, you were born a goy and now you've become Jewish or something like that. It's considered a terrible sin, a moral sin, to do something like that, because the ger is required. He has now become a member of the Jewish people, and so as a result he is a full-fledged Jew in every respect. Of course, we did learn that there are little exception is in the case of a woman, a gioris, that she is prohibited from marrying what? Kohen. She can't marry a Kohen. Okay.
No,
but listen, a good Jewish girl who is Jewish from birth but she was divorced, she also is prohibited from marrying a Kohen. So that's not a case, with so much discrimination. And if she had a bad moral character, so we learned also in that particular case,
she
can't marry, because the Torah says, Zoyna, the Chalola, and so on, So there are different, okay. But otherwise, a ger, 100%. So why all of a sudden is there a problem? Why should the Mishnah say that the ger does not make the declaration? So the answer is because the pasuk that he has to recite as part of the declaration is, we thank God that you have brought us to the land Asher Nishba La'avoseinu, right? Which God swore to give to our fathers. And of course, what's the problem? The problem is that his fathers, they weren't Jews, so that therefore the Mishnah says he does not make that declaration. Okay.
But if his pastor father is Abraham, then that's Avoseinu again.
Of course.
So
the truth of the matter is that the halacha is codified. Is that in spite of what the Mishnah says in this particular case, the ger
says
look,
makes the
we can argue likewise the same thing. We could argue, for example, that maybe a ger shouldn't recite the first bracha of the Shemoneh Esrei.
Yeah.
Right, because you say,
"Elokeinu,
Elokeinu, 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 Elokeinu,
Elokeinu, Elokeinu,
Elokeinu,
Elokeinu,
Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu,
Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu,
Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Elokeinu, Okay.
They don't say it, not that.
Yeah.
Oh, they had mothers.
No, they had
mothers.
Yeah, they sent me in a complimentary copy from the Jewish Theological Seminary. The new Shabbos morning sitter, so I saw it, what they say. The new Kunzenhof. Yeah, okay. Farbeset, always right. Farbeset adopted. Okay. So, at any rate, of course, well, you said that from the point of view of halacha, in reality, we don't follow that particular vision, okay? That the halacha says that they have to recite it, because in the final analysis, Abraham Avinu, as David hinted at, he was the spiritual father of all the Gerim.
Why is the sefer different from the halacha?
What?
Why does it differ? Why is it saying that it doesn't say it about the halacha? Why do we learn here that he doesn't say it in the halacha? We learn he does it, but it makes sense.
Okay, the answer is very simple. In the time of the Mishnah, whoever was the author of that particular statement, okay, felt that this was it. The Mishnah didn't discuss it any further, okay? So, from that point of view, I mean, it would be accepted as halacha. But along came later authorities who disputed that halacha, okay? Look, we find again and again, page after page, that we have a quotation from the Mishnah, and then they may be in agreement with it, or we'll have statements that, let's say, would be baraisas, in other words, other statements that came outside the Mishnah that, you know, either supplement or maybe refute some arguments or whatever it may be. And in many cases, we accept the ruling of the baraisa against the Mishnah. And what happens? And as the ages went by, so, you know, we have various codes of Jewish law. And people like the Rambam has his ideas, so he accepted mostly, but at the same time he also had ideas based upon teachings, let's say, of Gaonim who had already preceded him, like for example Reb Sadia Gaon, Reb Hai Gaon, Reb Natanai Gaon, and the other great Gaonim. I mean, these were great scholars. If you read who?
I mean, right in Bashat it says it. Right in
Bashat,
I mean, right in Torah.
Okay.
Right.
I'm not arguing. I'm only telling you that he wants to establish the fact, okay? Wants to establish the fact that we might make an argument, what? That maybe in the case of Bikurim, okay, you cannot draw an analogy from Bikurim and apply it to Maaser. Okay? Because what was the original question that we started with tonight? The answer is, can we eat Maaser Sheni Nushalayim Basman Hazeh? Does the law apply even though what? Even though there's no Beis HaMikdash. So first we brought in the business with the Bechor. But we said, maybe the Bechor is a special case because it requires a Mizbeach. Okay? And Maaser Sheni does not require a Mizbech, only requires being eaten in Yerushalayim, okay?
Right.
So then we bring in another case where a Mizbeach is not necessary from the point of view of the altar being used, let's say, to make sacrifices, but on the other hand, it is indispensable for the bringing of Bikurim. Because we have to place the basket of fruit down the right? Which means what? Before the altar. Okay? So he comes up with an idea then that, you know, you would argue, you know, that Kriya is indispensable, right? And you would argue that Hanukkah is indispensable. Well, we've already seen before in previous discussions that the rabbis in general agree that Hanukkah is indispensable. That's one thing that has to be done, because as we said, twice in the same paragraph they mentioned that it has to be put down before the altar. Okay? But as far as Kriya is concerned, so there are those who say that it's not indispensable. Okay? It's not ikuva, to use the language that the Gemara uses over here. In other words, it would hinder the full performance of the mitzvah. Okay? And if you don't do it, then you invalidated the whole idea. You understand? But nevertheless, right, so the, but he says, but even, all right, even you want to argue this, but nevertheless, what? The mitzvah still would be to do it. If you want to do it right, you do it right. That's all there is to it. So, okay, so he says, all right, there are times maybe that Kriya would not be necessary because of this. What
could
we
you
said.
Bring, could you bring Maaser Sheni? You can't bring Maaser Sheni today because you don't have a Beis HaMikdash, right?
That is correct.
Right, how about Bikurim?
Well, of course, the question is really about Maaser Sheni, all right?
Yeah.
Because with Bikurim, that definitely required the presence of the Beis HaMikdash. Yeah. So there's no question about that, okay? No Beis HaMikdash, no Bikurim, because of the fact that it has to be placed before the altar.
Right.
Okay.
On the altar?
Before the altar, okay. The altar itself was for the animal sacrifices. He didn't put this on it, okay? Don't forget, I mean, the Kohen ate it. Kohen and his family, they ate it after he gave it over to the Kohen.
So.
What?
I wondered if they walked up the platform.
No, they didn't have to walk up the platform. Okay.
I
mean, enough is enough.
So what about Meister Sheni?
Huh?
What about Meister Sheni then?
Yeah, we didn't resolve the question, however, Meister Sheni. You're 100% right. That has not been resolved. But nevertheless, how does the argument sound at this particular point? With all the refutation, and still, what do you think we're going to prove? That even Meister Sheni, Vazman Hazer, you cannot bring it to Yerushalayim and eat it over there. Okay?
Not this.
Because we don't have a Beis HaMikdash. And whatever comparisons we're making, whether it's to Bikurim, either to Bikurim or to Bechoros, right? Makes no difference. The point is that we don't do it today. So, but why? When I haven't resolved the argument as yet, okay? He says, inasmuch as he says that there is the case where the ger who brings his bikurim does not make any recitation, right? Because he has to say Asher Nishba Lavaseinu v'lo motzi. So for this reason he cannot, right? So Omar v'lo motzi Omar so lo psikale. All right, in that case, this is the reason why he didn't mention it at all, that there are such cases and so on. And that's why he didn't mention that Kriya is indispensable or something
like
that.
He can't change the declaration so the Ger could make the declaration?
Well, the Mishnah seemed to suggest that, which God gave unto your ancestors or something like that.
Because it's a declaration that's specified in the Torah, so you can't change it.
Yeah, right, exactly. The language of the Torah itself is Shodimbar Hashem Lavisenu. I mean, the suggestion was made to make a change, to your ancestors instead of our ancestors. But, okay. It's a moot point now,
okay.
If the Beis HaMikdash should be rebuilt in our own days and we once again bring Bikurim to the Beis HaMikdash, then all the Gerim are allowed to go and to bring it, because this is what the Rambam paskens and all the Chachamim after him. Okay? So he says, so the argument, he says, is revolving around the realm. The Tesi b'mehatzad. So you will have to resort to try to find Mahatzad. This is short for Mahatzad Hashomer. What is the thing which is equal in all the arguments? In other words, what is the common denominator in the argument? Okay? Mishum de'ikal mifrach, because you can ask the following question concerning what we were arguing about. He says, ma le'atzad hashove shobehen, what is the common denominator among them, that shekein yesh behen sad mizbeach, that they all require the presence of an altar, right? Umayko Savar, and what was the reason that he felt that all these things required an altar? We would say, sure. But maybe there's a possibility, we'll see what the argument is now. He says, Iko Savar, Kiddush HaRishon HaKitcho L'Shat HaVikitcho L'Sit Lo Boi. This is an argument that you find in the Gemara and Megillah particularly. Question is about the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. Okay? We all know that Eretz Yisrael is a holy land. But the question is, it's gone through different periods of time. Okay? Who was the first one who conquered Eretz Yisrael? Of course, the answer was Yehoshua. Okay? So Yeshua and the people of Israel, they conquered Eretz Yisrael, and then they divided among, various nachalot, in other words, different possessions among the various tribes, etc., etc., and so on, okay? And they sanctified it as a result, okay? And, of course, it was made even more holy, not only by the presence first of, the Mishkan, which followed them, from the wilderness and settled in various places like Shechem, Nob, Shiloh, and so on and so forth. And finally, of course, Shlomo HaMelech built the Beis HaMikdash, okay? So, the question is, however, and then along came Nebuchadnezzar, right? And what did he do? He destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. So the question is, with the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash by Nebuchadnezzar, did the land still retain its Kedusha, or did it lose its Kedusha? And of course, the same may be asked again about the rebuilding of Eretz Yisrael when the people who came back from Golas Bavel, like, you know, Ezra Bavel, and the prophets of those days, like Zechariah, Malachi, and so on, Zephaniah, Haggai, in the Kedusha, let's say, was reestablished for Eretz Yisrael with the rebuilding of the Beis HaMikdash. But along came the Romans, and they destroyed it, right? And they sent our people to Golas and so on. So the question is whether the Kedusha, Rishono Kitsho Lishato, the Kitsho Losit Lobo, if we say that the very time, the very first beginning to make this land into a holy land, it established the holiness of Eretz Yisrael, not only for its own particular period of time, that's the Shata, right, but also the Osid Lobe, in other words, for the future, in other words, right up to our own day and to future generations as well, so that the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael always remains. Now, if the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael remains, then maybe there is a possibility, what? That even if there is no Beis HaMikdash in Eretz Yisrael, but there are still mitzvos hatluyos ba'aretz, as we say, right? Mitzvos that are dependent upon living in Eretz Yisrael, that should be observed. The fact of the matter is that in Eretz Yisrael to this very day, if you live over there, you have to be aware that you take out trumos, masros, and so on. You do take it out, but not the way the Torah says. You do it symbolically, okay? You have what you call pidyon, in other words, you can redeem to a certain extent, you know, by saying this coin represents my pidyon, you know, for all the, you know, let's say the maestros, the trumas, and so on and so forth, that should be for the year. And, you know, or when you buy stuff in the, let's say, you buy fruit, vegetables, and so on, so you take a certain portion of it and you put it aside, you don't use it, and so on, okay? In Eretz Yisrael, it's a problem. No question, because we say that the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael in that particular case is still in effect, okay? But would this apply also to going to Yerushalayim needing Maaseh Sheni? So that this is the question. And of course the answer is no, it would not apply to eating Maaseh Sheni in Yerushalayim, because that should also be dependent upon there being a Beis HaMikdash. So the counter argument then would be then that, you know, it was Kidsho the Shato, right? Below Kidsho Lo Osid Love. In other words, only as long as there was a Beis HaMikdash was it a holy land. So as I say, our own position today is really, you know, somewhere in between these two points of view. In that we all say that Eretz Yisrael is holy and there are certain mitzvahs atluyos ba'aretz that have to be observed. But nevertheless, you cannot observe it the same way as you would if there were a Beis HaMikdash again in existence, when we could carry out in full the various rules and regulations that the Torah has told us. All right. So, Afilu Bechor, he says, look, if you believe that Kedusha Rishonah is Kitsha L'Shato V'Kitsha L'Oset Oveh, in other words, Eretz Israel is always a holy land, then he says, Afilu Bechor Nami. Then in that case, the Bechor too, you could argue, should be brought to Yerushalayim and eaten over there. In other words, his implication is that even though they don't have a Beis HaMikdash and so on and so forth, but maybe we could argue that you should bring